Mr. Jasinski?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is David Jasinski, and I represent the petitioner in this matter. The standard is very clear in these...
Do you want to raise that mic a little?
Sure.
So we can hear you.
Zach is equally tall, so it works out for both
of us. All right.
The standard in these cases are very clear, whether or not there was substantial record evidence to support the NLRB's decision in this matter. We've briefed this matter fairly thoroughly, and it's clear to us that there is not substantial evidence to support the support the NLRB's decision in this matter. This is a rather unique case from the perspective that the ALJ and the board found that there were a number of violations that the union committed in this matter. For instance, that they entered in this negotiation with a fixed position. That fixed position was that there were a number of subjects that were non-negotiable. That was a statement that was made by the union's representative at the very first bargaining session. That policy was endorsed and embraced by the second union representative that basically said their hands were tied and that they were not going to be able to make any type of changes with regards to a number of key components. Those facts that the ALJ found and the board found were completely disregarded in their ultimate conclusions in this matter. And I would turn the court to the Taft factors. And the Taft factors that set forth, one of those is that good faith bargaining on the part of the parties. And clearly by the ALJ's finding and the board's finding, there wasn't good faith bargaining by the union. And in addition to the fixed position that the ALJ found, there were other factors in the record, that being that there were regressive bargaining, that the union took a position at the very first bargaining session that there was a certain percentage for contributions.
They knew all that. They just weighed it differently than you'd like, right? I mean, you're overlooking the key fact, which is that the August 23rd negotiation, the union representative clearly said, we're not done. We want to come up with a counterproposal. Give us the information so that we can come up with a counterproposal. And the company never gave them that information.
Judge Griffith, respectfully, at the prior session, that same proposal that was in the prior session, the union was aware of that prior session. They never asked for any particular information at that particular prior session. It was only where the employer's representative stated,
isn't there some dispute about what was said at the prior session? Wasn't there an evidence in deposition that maybe Alcoff at the August 5th session discussed the possibility that there was another proposal coming down the road? Or am I remembering that wrong?
Respectfully, Judge Griffith.
That means I'm remembering it wrong when you say respectfully. I understand. Okay.
I was actually there, Judge. So from that perspective, Mr. Alcoff at the August 5th bargaining session said, "Why don't you accept everything else that the other employers have accepted?"
Right, right.
I mean that dovetails back into the whole position, the fixed aid bargaining position that occurred at the very first bargaining session, which the board placed. I will acknowledge, Your Honor, that the board placed substantial and too much weight, and I think they overreached. When they came to the conclusion that Mr. Alcoff said, well, there's maybe some wiggle room here, that there's something there. But that doesn't by itself cleanse everything that happened in all of the prior bargaining sessions. And I think what the board did in this particular case, and they've done it in other cases, but in this particular case, that they focus in on the contemporaneous understandings of the parties. And if you accept what the board found in this particular case, I submit that there would never be a case where an employer could actually reach impasse unless the union was unsophisticated to say, okay, you're right, we're at impasse. Short of that, you would have Mr. Alcoff, who comes in at the last session, and the board makes great.
What could Mr. Alcoff, and under your standard, what could Mr. Alcoff have done or could he have done anything at the August 23rd session, right, to hold off impasse?
I think that's a very interesting question, and the answer is yes. He could have made a proposal. He could have said that, we'll do this. Or there was never a proposal that came out. There were only words that suggested that there was a willingness, but nothing more than that. And then after the impasse was declared, he then says, well, I have all of these questions. And even the administrative law judge Davis in this matter acknowledged that could have been backtracking on the part of Mr. Alcoff, that could have been an attempt on Mr. Alcoff to thwart the impasse. So
let me ask you about the other negotiator. What could the other negotiator for the company, which turns out to be yourself, have done to make clear that there was an impasse? Because the board says, kind of lead you up to this point, the board says, you know, it looked like this was non-negotiable. They were going to hit impasse, and you said impasse. Mm-hmm. But then the board says, although the respondent claimed the parties were at impasse, Alcoff requested and the respondent agreed to schedule another bargaining session. Now, apparently the ALJ only says that you didn't have your calendar or something like that. I mean, did you, what is your recollection of this conclusion that you agreed to another bargaining session?
I believe the record evidence says that indeed that the employer said that it was willing to meet later, but that doesn't thwart the impasse issue. If the employer had said that we're never going to meet again, then clearly the employer would be guilty of bad faith bargaining. Just because an impasse is reached does not mean that the employer or the parties don't have an obligation to get back together. From the employer's perspective, it's our position that at that August meeting there was an impasse that was reached, not to bar any future meetings or future negotiation sessions. It was.
And are there magic words that can be used that will invoke impasse? I think you said something about final best. You know, final best offer. Are those magic words?
They're terms of art that's used in negotiations, yeah. where the parties take the position. Here, this is it. This is our last and best and final offer. And that was the position that we took, and we announced that we were at impasse.
And is there any way someone on the other side can undermine, can prevent impasse after those magic words are invoked,
sure.
Short of accepting the final best and last offer?
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, the parties had met for a number of months.
Right.
That there was,
although they hadn't discussed the pension fund, the benefit fund issue.
Well,
right?
It was discussed at the very first session,
one, right,
where it said not negotiable.
Right.
Mr. Foley, when he took over, said, our hands are tied, we can't do it, you know what our proposal is. In his memo to the president of the union.
So is it your view that impasse had been reached on that issue earlier than August 23rd?
There is an argument that can be made that by the union's actions at the very first session, that there could have arguably been impasse because of the refusal of the union to deviate and for them to announce that these are our fixed bargaining positions on this subject. And in our brief, we made reference to what we believe is the hypocrisy from the standpoint that if the employer had done that, if the employer had said this is a fixed bargaining position, we're not going to deviate from that, the board would have found that the employer was in violation. Did not do that here. They seem to have the board, and I believe that this comes full circle to the point that I wanted to raise earlier, and that is that what the board basically did, they focused in on a statement on the part of Mr. Alcoff at the very last session, and I would submit, Your Honors, it does not cleanse exactly what went on in the prior sessions.
The key here seems to be, I don't know if it's when impasse was declared or when it occurred, and if those two things are different, because on the one hand, you say, well, yes, I agreed to further bargaining because we're supposed to do that,
right.
the union asked for additional information, which you didn't give them, and presumably you were supposed to do that, if impasse doesn't mean you sever all relationship with the union, right?
Absolutely not. That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. So it's hard to figure out exactly when we say, and I think it makes a difference, you know, when we reach that point of impasse, how we look at what the union does after that.
I make no bones or hesitation. This is a slippery slope for an employer with regard, and it this case epitomizes that fact, where an employer entered into negotiations for good faith for months goes by, months, where there was unwillingness on the part of the union in terms of making any type of compromise. It basically went through surface bargaining for months. And then the employer announced that it's its final offer, and the union rep says, we're asking for all of this particular information. Your Honor, most of that information, if not all of that information, was given to them in prior sessions.
Well, what about the board's finding that in fact there was movement after all those months of not having any movement, that when Alcoff arrives there were a number of issues that were cleared, mm-hmm. and everybody agreed, so that actually that was a change?
I have a different spin on that particular finding, and my view is that for the first seven sessions they were a waste of time, because the union representatives really didn't have any authority to make any particular agreement. Mr. Alcoff comes in and engages in what I found offensive in terms of speed bargaining, where okay, we're going to do all of this. Why didn't that happen in the prior sessions? That goes to the bad faith on the part of the union. That goes to the fact that one of the factors in the Taft analysis that the board simply overlooked and completely disregarded. If the judges have any other questions.
All right, you can save
your
time.
Thank you, I appreciate it greatly.
All right, Mr. Pettit.
May it please the court, my name is Zachary Hennigy. I'm here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. It's true that this case, the primary issue in this case is the issue of impasse. I think the way that the negotiation sessions are framed by the company misses many of the points, misses much of what was going on during bargaining. While it's true that Mr. Jasinski testified during the trial that the union's position during the first session was that certain things were non-negotiable, we're talking, and they frame it as there's this Tuchman agreement that the union would not budge off of. During that point in the negotiations, it's important to realize that there was no Tuchman agreement at the other facilities. There was no master agreement at those facilities. So when the union made its first proposal in February 2005, they started off talking about non-economic things primarily. At that point, they were also able to talk about the health and welfare fund contribution rate, because fund trustees had set the rate. And that rate was going to be between 21% and 24%. That's not something the union could negotiate at the bargaining table. I think the negotiator properly said, our hands are tied to this. We at the negotiating table can't say to the fund, you need to give us a different rate. To give the coverage that the fund was going to provide, it was going to be between those figures. And at that point,
that they couldn't change the rate on the fund didn't mean they couldn't have gotten health care some other way, right? They could have negotiated about that.
That's correct. They could have negotiated for a different plan. And at that point, the parties, I think both parties, decided, well, let's talk more about the non-economic things. And the union brought up issues like visitation rights, seniority, transfers, and promotions. At the second session, the employer presents its proposal, and it's very clear that this isn't the time to talk about economic issues. If you look at their proposal on Joint Appendix 168 through 172, you'll notice under wages, health fund, holidays, vacations, proposals will be provided later. At that point, the parties are not talking about primarily economics, although there are some economic issues in the proposals. The next couple of sessions, and at this point,
why weren't they talking? Isn't it because the union had made clear from the outset that
I don't think that's absolutely right. The employer could have very well said, look, these are the wages that we're going for, and this is the direction we want to see negotiations. I think it's very common in negotiations, parties in collective bargaining negotiations, that parties talk about non-economics first and wait towards the end to work on the tougher issues of economics. And that seems to be, based on the evidence, what both parties were doing here. The next few sessions involved trying to figure out information and getting information from the parties. The company had requested information about the fund, so they were interested. And at the time, the company was actually using the fund to give coverage to their employees for health insurance benefits. The rates went up, and they wanted to know, you know, why the rates increased. So they asked the union for information, and the union was providing that information. At that point,
so is Mr. Jasinski wrong about the regressive nature of the bargaining? I mean, I thought I remembered that they kept coming back with higher numbers. Is that not what happened here?
There's no finding that the union was ever regressive. There's no finding that the union ever bargained in bad faith or surface bargained in this case. At the first proposal, the union said the rates were going to be between 18 and 24% as set by the trustees. At no point did it go above that. Even during the final sessions, it was at 22.33%. Later in negotiations, at this point, towards the middle of negotiations, the Tuckman agreement at the other facilities was being finalized. There was a tentative agreement in May, and by June, the end of June, it was finalized. And while the union had continued to push that framework, it's important to note that there was movement by the union during that period. During the earlier, when the union made its June 3rd proposal, the parties were still talking about information requests, but by the first full economic proposal by the union, which was June 17th, and this is JA 405, the union was asking for pretty much the same framework as the Tuckman Agreement. They wanted 4%.
Were these factors that the board relied on in saying no impasse? I thought that they were focused largely, if not exclusively, on what happened at the August 23rd negotiating session and the comments that were made by Mr. Alcoff after the company had announced this is our final offer.
Correct. I think that's absolutely right. I provide this as context to the negotiations.
You're providing the context for the negotiation. What I'm asking you is this the analysis the board went through?
No.
The board seemed to be relying on post-impasse conduct. And in Saramonte, we said that's a little too late. The board didn't go through the Taft. You're going through the Taft analysis now.
Partially to refute what you just heard.
Okay, but let's talk about what the board did. The board didn't go through the Taft analysis, did it?
It didn't. The beginning part, no. Part of it, it did discuss the contemporaneous viewpoint of the parties.
That's the only thing it did, and Saramonte suggests that that's not enough.
As a point of clarification, you said they focused on the post-impasse declaration.
Well, yeah, right.
The 23rd was the, and you need some of the context from the previous sessions to understand where the 23rd is.
Yeah,
yeah, but when you look at the board order, you think leading up to it, and it says, had that status quo persisted, that is, the union adhering to the Tuckman Agreement terms, the respondent refusing to contribute more than 16% of payroll, had that status quo persisted, an overall impasse might well have been achieved. It did not persist. And then this critical August 23rd meeting, and the board says simply, that changed everything because the parties agreed to meet again, the union would be preparing counterproposals, and there was at least professed flexibility on health insurance alternatives. So, I mean, we're really just looking at August 23rd.
Yeah, the board suggests something different than what you're suggesting. The board suggests look at all the facts and you're headed towards impasse. You're saying look at all the facts and there's this dynamic that doesn't lead to impasse.
Well, I didn't mean to dilute what the board was saying there. No, absolutely. On the 23rd, Larry Alcoff comes in. They're still in a stumbling block when they're talking about the health and welfare insurance plan. The company wants to pay 16% for it. The union says, look, that's just not possible. Mr. Alcoff, I think, provides...
Would you agree that once the company declares impasse, that we shift to Saramonte And if we're looking at comments that are made after impasse, that's not where we ought to be looking to determine.
I think if that's the case, then we're looking beyond what the board said. Okay. Because first we have a situation, the union says, let's look at other plans. Then impasse is declared in this case. At the beginning of that negotiating session, there was disagreement about the health care plan. The union says, we have to consider other plans. We're not going to get anywhere by doing this. There's a caucus. The company comes back and says, we're going to implement our last and final offer from our previous proposal, mm-hmm. which was loaded with takeaways from the previous contract. At that point, the union says, I said we needed to look at other health care proposals. We can't just do that without more information. So logically, the union says, you have non-union employees that have a health care plan. Let's look at that plan. Let's consider that as an option. We're going to need some information to understand what kind of coverage, how much that's going to cost us. And then the parties agree to meet again. That's much more fact-intensive than what was going on in Saramonte. First, there was already an impasse that nobody disputes in the Saramonte case. The issue in that case was also it was wages, where the union never asked for information, said, we'd be willing to consider your wage proposal. But when the company repeatedly said, give us a counterproposal, the union in Saramonte just said, look, we're willing to talk. Generally, and there's a lot of issues to talk about. Here, and I think as the court's recognized, what is the union supposed to do? They can't just full sail say, we'll just put any health care plan on the table and we'll accept it. They'd be disregarding their duty to their membership. They need to get information about the health care plan. And they say, we will develop a counterproposal for you. Instead of providing information about the insurance plan, the company goes silent. At that point, they don't respond to letters about meeting, or when they do respond, keeps on getting pushed off. They completely disregard the union's information request.
How do you respond to your opposing counsel's comment that the information being sought in those requests had already been provided, that this was just a charade that the union, those aren't his words, but my characterization of his comments.
And I think this is why it's important to look at what happened earlier on in negotiations. Early on in negotiations with the first negotiator, the company did provide certain information not regarding the health insurance plan, but other information regarding information about agency employees and different cost structures. The union at that point said, what we've got now suffices. And then in the middle of negotiation, there was still a lot of dispute over what information was being provided. And letters and evidence show that there was much back and forth about the union feeling like it wasn't getting all the information it requested. And then you get to this final session, and I don't think this is scrambling. When the company comes in and says, we're going to implement our first economic proposal that includes takeaways, where if you had worked 7 to 10 years at the company, you're now looking at losing 2 weeks of vacation pay. You're not going to get any of the legal fund contributions that you previously had. You're no longer going to get money going into an alliance fund that brought money into the industry, into the nursing home industry. You've got merit pay increases that can be given at any time at the employer's sole discretion. I don't know. I don't think the union was scrambling. At that point, they were really saying, look, if this is your serious final offer, we really need to understand what we're talking about here. But the employer, when at the table asked about these things, it says, we don't have any answers to your questions. And then when they formalize it in a letter a week later, they never get any information on it.
Why wasn't that request made earlier? How different was the proposal, the company's proposal on August 23rd from the one it had made at the previous session?
It was exactly the same, other than
So why weren't, if the union was in fact engaged in good faith negotiation, why weren't those questions raised then?
First, the proposal that was given, I believe it was July 8th, the employer's full economic proposal, as I mentioned, it had a lot of takeaways in it. And at that point, the company and the union were trading proposals. This isn't in the evidence, there's no finding of this, but perhaps the union felt that there was still a give and take, and maybe they didn't need all that information. It seems clear that they didn't think that was going to be the final offer, as evidenced by Elkhoff's statement saying, whoa, we're not at impasse, and we're surprised that you're saying that this is your final offer. So they continue to request information over the next almost 2 years. The company never provides that information. They haven't met.
It seems to me, based on the board's view of the matter, that the key fact here is what significance we place upon Mr. Alcott's statement at August 23rd. You've painted a narrative where there's this ebb and flow of discussion. Things are fluid. The board seems to recognize that what was going on was everyone was headed to impasse. The problem with what you're asking us to do is it would allow, in any setting, once impasse has been reached, to undo that impasse simply by saying, "Oh, I didn't think we were at impasse. Give us more information." And I think that just, you're right, Saramonte is distinguishable on facts, but that's certainly the sense of it, is that you can't stall impasse, you can't hold off impasse simply by offering, I think Judge Edwards' phrase was a handful of air, just these. And
I think that's a fair concern, and I don't think that's what you have to do here. I think when the union doesn't have a chance, when the parties haven't had a reasonable opportunity to go through the proposals, and if you look at the cases that we've cited where impasse...
Wait a second. I thought you just told me that the proposal that was being considered on August 23rd had first been made...
Just one session. Well, it wasn't the session before, but it was the session
before 2 weeks earlier, yeah.
Right. But in the session in between that, the union had made these concessions. They had gone through, and the union came in, they'd crossed out complete sections of their earlier proposal. The union was making movement. I agree. I'm not trying to, again, dilute from what the board's focus here is, because it does come down to that session where the union says, and I think reasonably so, we're willing to move. We're not getting anywhere on this health plan. But if you look at the rest of it, we're willing to provide a counterproposal. We need some information. Practically speaking, it is the employer's turn to give back a little bit, especially in this situation where there aren't very many sessions of discussion over this final proposal.
Let me ask you about this language that the board uses twice. After it leads up to the point that overall impasse might well have been achieved, and then it says, rather than test the union's stated willingness to move, and then it says later, in rejecting the impasse, it did not test that doubt, that is, the doubt that the union was really going to move.
Right.
Really had a counterproposal.
Right.
Let me ask this. I mean, first the board says you declare impasse and you use these magic words and to the employer and you've got impasse. However, you can't just stop talking to the union. Now they're saying you've got to test that doubt if you think the union is just stalling or staving off impasse. That seems like a very amorphous requirement that the employer, after declaring impasse, then has to test a doubt that the union, by saying, wait a minute, we might have something here.
I think you can't take that away from the facts in the case. In the fact where the fact scenario is like this, where there's a request by the union for the information to the significant, the most relevant issue that's on the table at this point, where they're willing and they've given willingness to go and move off of that, off their original position, the employer needs to do something.
Well, what I'm asking, I guess, is this, that after the impasse declaration, the board seems to be saying there's a new twist to this. You have to test any doubt you might have. Even though you think there's impasse and you've declared impasse, you being the employer, you still have to test a doubt when the union doesn't just roll over and say, okay.
I think when there's more to negotiate, where there's been movement by the union or the other party, I think that they need to, like I'm saying, act. They need to act. They need to test that the union isn't just trying to scramble, isn't just trying to delay. If the company in this situation would have provided the union with the information for the health plan, and the union would have said, forget it, we want to stick with our health and welfare plan, we'd be in a completely different situation.
Clearly inconsistent with Saramonte, isn't it? I mean, you're saying that, It's one thing, I suppose. It's hard to figure out exactly what's going on here because the board says, well, it looks like an impasse, and maybe it was an impasse, but they said something different, which really has the effect of sort of abrogating what we said in Saramonte, because it says even if it looks like an impasse and there's been no movement, if the union then says, oh, well, maybe we will consider it, the employer has to go beyond that, right, to see if they're really serious.
I think in this case the board is saying more than the union just needs to say something. And in this case they said and did something. They not only said they would be willing to look at this other plan on the most important issue, they said that they would be making a counterproposal as soon as they had the information, and the parties agreed to meet again. I think those extra factors not only distinguish it from Saramonte, but doesn't require the court to change its position on Saramonte.
I'm not so sure, because the board says the professed flexibility of the union on the health insurance alternatives, and then the employer's got to test that.
And again, I think that looking at Saramonte and the facts in that case make it clear that where you're talking about wages, where there's no information request that's coming back, when you're talking about a health care plan, where it's not clear that it's a matter of, okay, we're giving up 50 cents on our last proposal. Getting information on a health care plan requires you're looking at coverage, you're looking at cost structures. It's much more complex. And I think it's fair to say the union needs some of that information to understand what they might be agreeing to down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Jasinski have? Okay.
Your Honor, if I could just bring to your attention with regards to the information, it seemed like that was an issue. In Mr. Foley, who was the second union representative, when he resigned from the negotiations and canceling the July 15th session, in a letter to me, and it's in our brief, where he said, management knows the outline of our proposal. In the discovery of this case, and as part of the record, there was a memorandum that Mr. Foley provided to Millie Silva. It was kind of a transition memo in terms of the status of the negotiations. Mr. Foley in that memo made certain characterizations with regards to me, but what the most important aspect of it is that never during in that memo did he say that there was any request for outstanding information or that the employer had not provided any information. That would have been the place for that information request to have been confirmed or solidified. It was not. And the reason it was not is because the employer had given the union every bit of information that they had requested. If not, Mr. Foley clearly in that memo would have come out with it. Mr. Alcoff, when he took over, clearly would have asked for it, did not ask for it until the employer made its declaration in terms of impasse. I could reiterate many of the things Ms. Pomplaska and the ALJ found that Ms. Pomplaska in the negotiation said certain provisions were non-negotiable. There was never any claim that they were bound with regards to 18% or 24%. Said certain things were non-negotiable. One of those was with regards to health insurance, wages, that there were other provisions that the union representative made in that chilling statement that these issues were non-negotiable. There was no a doubt with regards to what the union's fixated position was at that first session and carried on throughout. Those are my comments, Your Honor.
I do have one question. Again, the board, and just to save me from having to go through the record, when the board says the evidence the hearing establishes the union, in fact, agreed to contracts with six other nursing homes that did not include the benefit fund, was that after August 25th?
Absolutely, Judge. And I'm glad you brought that point up. Those were facts that occurred after the negotiation was occurring between the parties in this particular case. We had no knowledge with regards to any of those things that were going on.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.